one of the things that you must master. Reason being that other members will have to leave for the province of the Eastern Cape, because tomorrow is the funeral of one of the members, Mr. Ness, who was in the National Assembly. So there is a delegation from Parliament to attend that funeral, and the chairperson is one of those people. So when you go to Canal Walk, you must not go via Kemps Bay from Parliament. You must go straight to Canal Walk. Don't go this way before going to Canal Walk. That's how our discussions will be. We must be just straightforward and do things according to book. The book is that is in front of me as the chair of the session. I welcome everybody, particularly the Department of Monitoring and Evaluation. And the legal services of Parliament. Welcome the Department of Communication, ably led by the Acting Director General. At least I have a letter that says from the Minister. That's the Acting Director General who lead the delegation. Because I'm not in a relaxed mood, so I won't attempt to name him by surname, because I need to relax when I say his surname. Welcome also the FPB led by the Deputy Chairperson. Tell the Chair that we miss her, Mem Mangena. Tell her that Honorable Mashagwana misses Mem Bumlwana. Remember yesterday I was saying those who are coming from the north must call me Mashagwan, and then the others can call me Makagwan. So that's FPB, and the guests from the industry, you're welcome. Honorable members, because everybody here is your guest, so I can't welcome you. I can only say get ready for the meeting, because I've welcomed everybody on your behalf. I dealt with the apology of the minister. I have the written apology from the minister, and I will advise the office of the deputy minister. Please, man, when the deputy minister is not going to attend the meeting, write an apology. But also, when she is going to be in the meeting, both the minister and deputy minister, they must be here. If it's half past nine, they must be here at half past nine. This thing of saying in 4 minutes' time she will be here, it must end. I don't know why she's calling me, because she knows that I'm chairing the meeting, this deputy minister of hers. So I'm welcoming everybody. And I know she wanted to talk to me to say she's attending to another commitment. You better answer her. So those are the apologies I have, members. Any other apology? Standing apology of Mr. Ndlozi, Honorable Tedi, I think the chief won't like this. Someone talking about the provincial work when we have a committee of parliament. Because Mr. Honorable Tedi says parliamentary work commitments, I mean provincial work commitments. We don't accept that. Mr. Self, listen to this. This thing says no reason given. Mr. Self, was standing in for Ms. Van Damme. Honorable Van Damme is on leave. Study leave. So Mr. Self was just standing in. But Honorable Van Dijk is here for the TA. So those are the apologies, and I think we must not spend any more time on them and allow the leader from the PME to introduce the delegation, and after that get into business. Thank you very much. Over to you. Introduce yourself and your team.
Good morning, Honorable Chair. Good morning, Honorable Members. Thank you so much for material important milestone for us to be invited by the Communications Portfolio Committee to present this particularly important area of work that we started during the course of last year. My name is Rudy Dix. I'm a Deputy Director General responsible for Outcome 4, which is the economy, Honorable Chair, and also for Outcome 6, which is on economic infrastructure. The socioeconomic impact assessment falls under the Outcome 4 area of work. My colleague to the right over here is Ms. Pulani Kole. She is the Chief Director, Head of Socioeconomic Impact Assessment Unit under Outcome 4. Can I continue, Honorable Chair?
It's only two of you.
Thanks, Honorable Chair. Just by quick introduction, Pulani will do most of the presentation. But I thought just two areas that we wanted to just emphasize. I know in the communication that we received from the Secretariat of the Portfolio Committee, Honorable Members, referred to a regulatory impact assessment. So regulatory impact assessments was something that the Cabinet had adopted in 2007. We no longer use the terminology regulatory impact assessment because Pulani will explain why that is important. So just for noting that it's called socioeconomic impact assessment systems and not regulatory impact assessment systems. The second point that I thought would be important to make, Honorable Chair, is that one of the historical areas of regulatory impact assessment is that it always was criticized, particularly from a point that it opened up quite a significant gap for externalization of impact assessments of particular policies, legislations, or even regulations. And it opened up a huge market for external consultants. And for us, we wanted to end this, primarily. And so this is one of the most successful programs in the shortest possible time, Honorable Chair, Honorable Members, that we were able to set up during the course and internalize the process. Because one of the things that RIA did was to say, we got a policy, we got a bill, can you as a consultant do this? But the officials who are responsible for the policy development and for the implementation tend to then outsource it to someone else and don't necessarily understand the implications of what it means in relation to an impact assessment. And so part of our process has been to successfully internalize it amongst many, many departments and many, many units. I thought that's important areas just to note before Pulani provides an introduction on very concisely as you've directed us on what socioeconomic impact assessment is in government. Over to you.
Thank you, Honourable Chair, and greetings to Honourable Members. The presentation will cover introduction and background, CS within the policy and planning framework, the application, implementation progress, and some of the key learning points. The National Development Plan, the medium-term strategic framework, as well as outcome 4, prioritize a need to actually reduce the burden that is placed on inclusive growth resulting from our unintended consequences of government, as well as inefficient and inappropriate regulations. And some of these obstacles include the costs that exceed the hope for benefits. We develop laws, we develop policies only to find that the costs actually outweigh the benefits that we hoped for during our policy or legislation development. And also protracted turnaround times to deliver services. You find a consumer and investor has to go to several departments to get authorization, for example, of a particular permit, because those departments are governed by different legislations and they have their own procedures. And at the end of the day, it's confusing to the investor or somebody who wants to use government products to actually enhance economic growth. Some of our laws policies come with excessive risk leading to implementation failure, which maybe they were not anticipated also during the development of those particular laws or policies. We have learned also from the immigration regulations having good intentions, but other sectors suffered from those unintended consequences. And also delays on implementation of laws and regulations due to litigations or lack of buy-in. We sometimes consult, you know, only few that will support, but during implementation, you know, you are taken to court now and again to explain yourself because other groups were not consulted or, you know, they were not given an opportunity to shape your policies or legislation. So CS was then approved by Cabinet last year, 2015, to also replace or build on the work of the regulatory impact assessment. But also to say when we develop policies, laws and regulations, let's be mindful of the key priorities of government within the NDP to say our thinking should be supporting what is of concern to the country, like high levels of poverty, inequality, the challenges on economic growth, spatial imbalances and environmental degradation. So CS actually help us to think of all these issues and also to say when you introduce a policy or you amend the existing legislation, be mindful that there are always risks that are associated with it and to say how do we plan for them and have a proactive way of mitigating those risks, but also understanding the costs that are associated to say also with the challenges that we have. The financial constraints, how best can we produce more with the less resources that we have, and also to say if I'm bringing a new policy or I'm amending the existing one or I'm coming with a new legislation, am I adding burden to economic growth or am I bringing more efficiency and better coordination to deliver services faster? So in terms of application, it meant that all new policies, regulations and legislation have to be subjected to CS, even those that are being subjected to reviews or amendments. So the implementation date that was officialized by Cabinet was last year, 1st of October 2015. So there were some transitional arrangements that were put in place because the system was introduced last year while you know government programs were running. So there was some awareness trainings you know to actually institutionalize the CS. Learning also from the introduction of RIA, it was not evenly institutionalized across departments. We had other departments like DIA that had a strong unit that support the RIA, but other departments were not even aware of the RIA. So we had to make sure that all departments are aware of CS and to actually help them to apply the system. So there was a transitional period last year between June and September to allow departments to institutionalize and to begin applying the fears in you know, the policies and laws that were developed. So there was also changes that happened with our cabinet guidelines and memos to now also include the socio-economic impact as part of reporting. So in terms of the transitional arrangements, it also meant that for the legislations and policies that were in advanced stage that were developed prior to CS, some legislation were started as far as 2008-2009. They were given an exemption to only do apply the final impact assessment that I will also discuss in the presentation. And also to say bills that were already introduced to Parliament could not be withdrawn and be subjected to CS. We know the expropriation bill was already introduced in Parliament when CS was introduced. And bills that were already approved by Cabinet also could not be withdrawn and you know, reversing the decision and subjecting. So it also impacts on the bill that is going to be discussed by the Department of Communication. So new proposals or new amendment initiated from 1st of October had to be subjected to the initial impact assessment. So these are just some of the differences between the cost-benefit analysis, the former regulatory impact assessment, and the socio-economic impact assessment. So with the CBA, which is commonly used, it's around understanding the cost and the benefits of particular program or project. So it's more at the program level. And with a decision to say whether this project will benefit the society or the benefits are actually outweighing the cost. And it's mostly done by a consultant outsourced. And the regulatory impact assessment was more focusing on to make a decision whether the draft law, you know, the likely economic costs are actually exceeding the benefits. And at the end is to decide whether we adopt or reject a particular law. And as Rudy indicated, it was mostly outsourced and with lack of support or buy-in internally. So the socio-economic impact assessment allows us to understand the only not only economic costs, but also the social benefits as well as the risk and the cost. And to say, now that you understand what the risks are or the cost, do you have ways of mitigating them so that you are able to maximize the benefit thereof? And it's mostly done internally by the policy owners, also by those who are drafting the laws, because they are content owners and they should be able to step outside their policy or legislation development and be able to critique the policies or the laws that they are developing. So it's not a compliance process, it's a thought-through process that even stands outside your policy or legislation development, and it even asks you the rationale behind a policy or legislation development. Do you see a problem and rush to develop a law or amend the existing? Or you know, and to say, if I have to amend, if I have to come with a new legislation, how does it fit to the national development plan? How does it address the issues of concern to the country? But it also takes you into the implementation mode. So it's not about, you know, having a policy or a bill being assented to by the president, but to say, how are you going to implement it and make sure that it addresses the problems that you initially wanted to identify? So we are always looking at socio-economic costs, benefits and risks, but not only at the quantifiable economic costs. And also there are some legislation, because of their complexity, where you have to do a detailed level of quantification. For example, the national health insurance, we have to understand what will be the cost per patient, what will be the implication to our medical aid schemes and the like, what will be the cost to come with a unit that will administer the whole NHI. But in most of the time when we do facilitation, it's also to understand the key cost drivers that will support the implementation of the policy or the legislation. So there is a relationship of the CS also with the manner in which we do our strategic plans and our APP. So our argument is that if you have a poorly developed legislation or policy, it will even affect your program design. So you will implement, you will spend budget, you will increase your staff, but the problem will not go away. So CS allows us to say, from policy point of view or legislation, let's understand the problem and be able to identify critical areas of addressing those problems that will also further be translated into our APPs and strategic plans. And in terms of the application, we have two types of assessment, the initial and the final. So the initial impact assessment happens at an early stage. You have identified a particular problem that needs to be addressed. So it asks you the details of the problem that you have to solve and to say, out of the problems that we have in the country, why are you particularly interested in addressing this particular problem? And to even understand the causal effect, the root causes of that particular problem, with the understanding of the whole theory of change, to say, if we address this particular root causes, then the problem will go. But also understanding the behaviors that are also contributing to a particular problem. Behaviors can be from other government departments, from private sectors and other stakeholders. And to say, when you are introducing a policy bill, how are you going to address those behaviors so that you have a seamless implementation and even support that complements the requirements of your policy or legislation? But it also allows you to look at different options of addressing a particular problem, to say, do we amend, do we come with new legislation, or do we strengthen our internal mechanism to actually implement the existing policy or legislation? So at the end of the day, it allows you to say, we arrived at a particular option, not because we are biased to it, but we are able to look at other options of addressing that particular problem, and we realize that it's the best option in a way that even the identified risk and cost can be managed so that we are able to yield greater benefits. So the final impact assessment looks at your options along your policy development or legislation development to say, is the option that we chose still relevant with the changing circumstances? You know, the challenges of drought, fish mass fall, is it still relevant when you know, the policy or the law gets further research and engagement with the stakeholders? And it also takes you in to say, who's going to benefit from the policy or the legislation that you are coming up with? To say, in a highly unequal society, high levels of poverty, where is the biasness of your policy or your legislation? And the behaviors that need to change to complement the implementation. But also the key one is more also on consultation, to say, have you consulted? But it's not only about consultation, but to say, what are the views of different groups? And what is your view as a department when you consult? Are you incorporating those inputs that, into your bill or your policy? And if not, why are you not considering, you know, the opposing views from other stakeholders? And to say also, when you introduce a rule, there will be other groups that will support, others that will oppose. But to say, do you have dispute settling mechanisms to deal with those, you know, so that you are also minimizing the litigation costs against the state? And to say, do you have those mechanisms? So you have even other legislations that establishes your tribunal mechanisms, or even have a clear appeal process to say, if a particular group is not happy with a particular decision, this is a clear appeal process for you to actually follow. And also to say, what are the risks of your option and the mitigation? And the key also part on the CS is the monitoring evaluation, to say, how will you know over time that your proposed legislation or policy is addressing the problems that you have identified? And if not, how are you going to deal with those? So it shouldn't take us 20 years to realize that this legislation is not actually good in addressing a particular problem. And also, you know, it allows you to appreciate, to say, well, that was a good policy or a good legislation in addressing a particular... So that's basically the content of the final impact assessment. This is a process map. It's not a linear one, but to say, you know, there will be a mandate to develop a policy or a law, which is will always be our executive authorities who have the power to actually introduce a particular law or policy. But with the whole process, it says when a department is initiating, we need to work with them throughout the process so that we provide support on the application of CS, but also independent subject comments to shape the whole policy or legislation. And at the end of the day, there will be a sign-off from our side when all issues have been addressed, where we issue a sign-off form for quality assurance. So we're not using the certificate like the chief state law advisors. We use the sign-off and the whole process will go through the authorization within the department or by cabinet. So even before a particular bill is introduced by parliament, it will go through cabinet. But before even go to cabinet, cabinet will say go and do the socio-economic impact assessment. Otherwise, we are not going to process it. So that's the whole process that we are dealing with. So in terms of implementation, we have the unit that provides support. We have even cabinet office that ensure that all policies and bills are subjected to CS. The interdepartmental steering committee that support with guidance and training. And we have CS champions now in departments to ensure the further, you know, application of CS to policies and bills, who are also communicating with us all the time to assist. So we are providing training, and we also realize that policy and legislation making is highly decentralized. So all the time we are providing inductions to the policy initiators or the law drafters. So this is a progress in terms of to say departments actually welcome the system. It's institutionalized. Between the period of June and 31st, we had about 117 proposals that were subjected to CS, and mainly the bills that were, you know, subjected to CS. And for the first quarter, we had about 67 submissions, and some were resubmissions based on our comments and the support that we are giving to departments. And then for the second quarter, we had about 86 submissions, the first-time submissions, so we have 40 new proposals that were subjected to CS. Others were revisions based on our analysis and support. So in the main, some of the key learning points is that CS has actually brought different disciplines together to have dialogue and inputs on policy making, your M&E people research, the line function, legal services, and we have seen even other departments calling other affected departments to be part of the policy development and legislation. But we also dealt with issues around overlapping mandates. I develop a policy or a bill, it affects another department, I'm not actually properly consulting. So we had to deal with some clashes of certain mandates and to calling different, you know, affected departments in one room to actually deal with those issues. So it actually supported the implementation of the principles of cooperative government as included in Chapter 3 of the Constitution. So in other issues, it's a rush process. You identify a problem and you want to touch the Principal Act, and when we facilitate, we realize that there's nothing wrong with the Principal Act. The problem maybe is to increase enforcement and to, you know, improve our monitoring or compliance processes. So those are some of the things that we had to deal with, and to also to say how do you actually link your whole process with the NDP priorities. And sometimes it's unrealistic assumption or mismatch where we think the bill will address all the problems, but we always encourage to say with better collaboration, working with other departments, you can be able to address a particular. Hence, you even find other legislation will say the minister in consultation with the minister of this department, they will jointly address a particular problem. And sometimes it's more of lack of adequate identification and analysis of the risk that may impede implementation. And also, we are working with the cabinet office to also improve the manner in which we implement the legislative program. So sometimes we commit to parliament that we are going to bring 100 bills, but you find that that whole process is not properly managed. We didn't do proper planning in terms of our stakeholders, and so those are some of the things that we are working with the cabinet office so that we adhere to our timelines. So that's basically some of the key learning points around the implementation of CS. Thank you very much, Chair.
Perhaps just two points of emphasis, Honourable Chair, that my colleague Polani has made. The first one is that the CS process, and it's important that Honourable Members understand that it's not a legal process. It's not saying that the prescript is written wrong or not. Because I think sometimes when we initially introduced this, there was an impression that this is about the legality of how something is written. You know, it's about understanding the risks, it's about understanding the social and economic benefits or not benefits. So I think it's very, very important. And when we initially started out, Honourable Chair, one of the things was that when we train departments, they send all the legal departments. And of course, that's problematic because it's not about legal. It was bringing together the legal departments and the policy department to say, you have to understand the process. It's not about the legality of this. The second point that I just want to re-emphasize about this, Honorable Chair, is that Pulani had made this point, and I think we just have to emphasize it, that it cannot be seen as a compliance tick box tool. So sometimes what we initially thought was that many departments thought, okay, we'll just fill in the blank spaces because it's a template. You know, now it's easy to catch out someone, if I must say that in a very crass way, that you can see when someone has cut and pasted into the document. And so we have to quality assure and ensure that it's not seen as a compliance tool, that departments internalize it, understand what problem they're trying to address, and what are those particular risks, and whether in fact the CS that they've done and the outcomes of the CS is then fed back into whatever policy, whatever bill or whatever regulation. So it's very, very important to understand that it's not a tick box and a compliance, and one can pick it up quite quickly. And so it's an emphasis of having to manage with departments continuously to understand that it's not a compliance-driven thing. I mean, one of the problems, Honorable Chair, that has been raised by some of the departments is this is just a delay. But the delay is better than having to continuously submit it to cluster, submit it to cabinet, and it gets kicked back every single time. Even when it comes to parliament, it gets kicked back because some of the risk has not been adequately addressed. Thank you, Chair.
Thank you very much, TPME. Some of us have sinus. The aircon is creating problems for us. Can someone switch it off? Maybe I should also welcome Honorable Mlinda and Honorable Dudley. I know Honorable Dudley came earlier than you, Honorable Mlinda. But at the time I was welcoming members, I didn't mention her. But thanks for coming, Honorable Dalton. Honorable Mbinda has been in this committee for some time. I know you come when we have time, so it's quite appreciable. members, I will hand over to you. I know there will be this shift from RIA to CESA. Yes, what is it?
Yes.
That transition, it will take time, even in our tongues. I will hand over. But before you go on, I can't remember the surname now. Kule, as in K-U, K-O. You were talking about the conflict between departments. I don't know. Toward the end of your input, you're talking about the conflict between the departments. Did you catch that? Because I want you to explain more. Here we are dealing with the DOC, and both FPB and ICASA belongs to this department. They don't belong to other departments as entities. So maybe as an explanation or as your understanding, you need to just to explain your understanding on that one. I will hand over to Honorable Kalako, Honorable Kungubele, Honorable Van Skalvik, Honorable Machoba, Honorable Van Dijk, Honorable Dudley, Honorable Mbinda, and Honorable Tolash. You can see that, so that if one is covered or doesn't have anything to say, I just pass. So I'm giving members, all of them, to say something, if there is something. Honorable Kalago?
Chair, this is very interesting, Chair.
You know, I don't know where were you guys. We always knew that there is this Department of Monitoring and Evaluation. And it's the first time that you come before a committee. It's the first time I've been in many committees in this parliament that this unit comes and talk to us. Because, you know, the chair has just mentioned this. You see, we're dealing with this amendment bill. And you'll find within the within the department itself, departmental units, there are disagreements on certain issues which the department is dealing with, trying to make sure that there is some sort of a consensus position on issues. So you are saying one of your roles is to make sure that departments consult, because in legislation there's that part, have you consulted this, have you consulted public participation, all those things. So you are saying that's one of your roles which you do in trying to minimize conflict, sometimes in trying to minimize, which happens. You see, our legislation, we're accused, especially by investors in South Africa, that our legislation and regulations of similar departments, especially maybe in economic transformation of government, they are talking different things, but all of them want to achieve attraction of investment, growth of the economy. But you'll find investors saying to us, what the DTI says about the broad-based economic empowerment and what the mining charter says, which is addressing the same thing, is not the same. And it gives confusion to investors and those who want to. So my question is, because you are saying if any legislation, any bill have not gone through this new adopted process now, it won't be adopted by cabinet. And then the minister, after adoption by cabinet, usually refers it to us in parliament. So this one, this amendment, was it its period when it was initiated and done? Was it before the cabinet adopted this socio-economic assessment impact systems, or was it after? The second question is it, I haven't heard you correctly, I don't know, maybe if I remember last time, our parliamentary legal team tended to imply to me that this is not necessary in this bill. It can even be done after the bill have been adopted. If you can just clarify me on those two. So that we called you precisely because we had that, you know, the lawyer confused us worse last time, and the arguments which resulted as to say, we want you to come and explain. In fact, department itself was confused. The chief director was presenting was confused. So if you can just explain those two for me, that way. Otherwise, this is to me a very useful presentation, Chair, for us.
Thank you very much. Now, rest assured, TPMA, we are going to call you all the time. I think if communication never used this department, it was a mistake. I'm sure they know that in agriculture, Dr. Ngomane was like part of the committee, because we needed this voice from TPME. So ever since we came in 2014, we've been using TPME until yesterday as agriculture, because I saw them with her yesterday. And I think you will be part of this committee all the time, because this is very important to have that view from TPME. Mamtela shesi hamba ngomgqa kesizwe. Everybody speaks. Because if I don't manage this meeting, there will be a problem. It was at 2 o'clock, must be done here.
Thank you, Chairperson. Good morning, everybody. Chair, I haven't much to say except to say it was a well and very good presentation. Especially that communication is a new department. I think they must just sit with this department forever. The only in their slides they spoke about, you know, when you talk consultants, we become very worried, because in the years that we are being in democracy, we must have been able to develop some skills within. So when you talk consultants, I would want to hear more whether those cannot be done internally, especially talking this department that has got this mandate over everybody else. Thanks, Chair.
Yeah, thank you, Chair. I must confess up front, I was worried about what's happening until the whip clarified me. Because I think my mind is set up that the department must just present to us the results of impact assessment, or at least the plan to do that. Because I'm still very clear in my mind. I don't understand why a scientific, prudent, and sensible thing is debatable. So there are certain things you can debate. There's a debate that doesn't make sense. So that's my attitude. But I've been assisted by the whip that they are assisting to make our case even stronger. So I nearly pointed my guy at the wrong at the wrong side. I was going to ask you, what are you doing? Because all the things you say, we believe, we agree with. So why are we wasting time discussing what you are presenting here when we are supposed to implement it? Now, I'm told, no. Remember, you made the case, guys. Now, the case is being strengthened today. Now, then, you've made my day. But what I wanted to say is that, Chair, it goes back to, if I get a slight deviation. Remember, I was speaking about a situation where, because there's this accountability, this institutional relation between Parliament, Executive, and various other institutions, the commonality of language that is used is going to be very key, so that we make sense to one another when we speak. And what keeps on frustrating me is that you listen to the department's reporting, we've got different understanding of common words. And once we've got different understanding of common words, to think that we are making sense with one another, it's just a formation of, we are just consolidating insanity, I'm sorry to put it that way. Because, you see, in the mental hospital, insane people, they think that there's nothing wrong with themselves as they talk to one another. It's similar when we use one word, when we use one word, understanding it differently, and thinking that we are making sense in that relationship, it's similar to a mental hospital situation. Now, this department, like you have said, Chair, to me, becomes very critical to deal with what I was proposing, that this issue of performance information, this is the principal department for it. This one. This is the principal department. This department has got a primary duty, together with AG and all other auxiliary institutions, to assist the entire parliament with the executive and everybody to speak a common language. One of the worst things that are messing up on earth is how we undermine the discipline of communication. We love and hate one another purely on messing up, on doing well, on communication. We make friends and enemies purely on doing well or badly on communication. And there are tools of communication. Now, this thing of performance information, I want to argue to M&E unit, I don't think we're taking it. You guys have done good work. I've seen some of your work. But I don't think you have done stronger work in being, in a regulating that it is implemented properly to make sure that all departments comply with that language, to make sure that even us as parliamentarians, we're taken through, managers are also taken through, we force ourselves to speak a common language. Having listened to you, that becomes very important. And I think there is no argument why we should lessen the burden of good, of well-intended actions. Because this is what we argue here. We are saying there are intentions by government which translate in various types of interventions. And then this CESA is to ensure that you eliminate all the unhelpful elements in trying to do that. So that the purpose for which this intervention was designed is served. So I'm saying there's no need to debate that. Because this makes logical sense. Now, where I'm sitting here, I want to believe that there's this question that if this bill was already implemented, I'm asking a question. If this amendment is done when CESA is in place, what is wrong to subject this amendment? Because if we ignore the burden of the bill when it was originally implemented, we cannot add a new burden when there's a system to avoid a new burden. The question we must answer now, should we add a new burden in the old bill which was not assessed, or should we use the new intervention not to, to introduce new burden over and above the one which was not eliminated? And to me, the pragmatic attitude is that I see no reason why are we debating subjecting this thing so that it does not complicate what is already there. Because if you say this bill was not done because this process was not there, it doesn't make it a good bill. It means the bill has got defects in terms of cost issue, regulatory burdens, and all those things and whatever. Because this bill, this amendment, is an economic, it's not just a social intervention, it's an economic intervention. It's got serious impact, not just in terms of how you implement it, in terms of its burden to those who want to invest in that space. So it's a bigger thing. So all I'm saying is that going forward, we can't continue to do wrongdoing. Let me say, we cannot say because in the principal bill, a wrong thing was allowed. Therefore, in amending it, we continue with its wrongness. It's not going to make sense, in my view. So all I'm saying is that your presentation made the case, because what we're trying to argue with the legal team of the legislature was that we've got a rational obligation as parliamentarians. The fact that we're expected to process a bill, we are required to think normally, so that when we present it, all the things that leave an inquiring mind are clarified. And so when somebody says, why did you say, to the best of our understanding, this is what we did. So that was the clash between us and the legal team. Because legal team, in my view, were saying, technically, this is what you are expected to do. And they said, but rationally, that is where the debate began. We say, you can't say a committee like this does not have a rational obligation. And now you are making scientifically a case for rational obligation. All I'm proposing is that if we can agree, that this amendment, within economically acceptable time, to me, it cannot be allowed to follow the same way the principal, its principal followed. Let's help the principal to be better with the new amendment. without going to the elements of the first elements of the principle. I'm not sure if I'm clarifying myself.
Thank you very much. It says seas, not seisa. There is a system. Yeah, seas. No, no, it's not. It's not. It's seas. Honorable Van Kalvik.
Thank you, Chairperson. I would like to welcome the presentation. It was very informative and really refreshing receiving it. So I would like to refer to page 6 of your presentation, where you refer to the cost-benefit analysis, the regulatory impact assessment, and then CS. In the first two, you, in the area of who does it, you say that both the first two are being done by consultants, but the CS is done by drafters with technical and policy support if required. So I would like to know if this capacity is in-house, or are you using at any stage consultants to perform this function? What I'm also interested is the seeing that this needs to be done in terms of allowing legislation to be passed. I would foresee that there will be an influx of legislation. So do you have the necessary capacity to deal with the influx, and what is the timeline, the maximum timeline attached to this process, taking into consideration it only started a year ago, and as it will become more relevant in passing legislation, it might be that the timelines that you had during the past few months won't be the same going forward. So did you take that also into consideration, the influx of regulation legislation? Thank you, Chair.
After his speaker, the following must speak. Honorable Machola.
Well, thank you, Chair, and thank you for the presentation. I don't have much after my colleagues outlined the reality. I think, Chair, this department, as a new baby, is growing with passion, performance. I think I only have clarity. I want clarity to page 12. I'm not clear about the number of officials, whether is the officials were exposed to in induction, or they were making application for employed to cease. I'm just need clarity around that, because if you see at the 31st of March 2016, 171 prescripts subjected to cease. So I need a more elaboration about that. What is it about this 581 officials? I think really currently this department is in good direction, Chair. I can only say, but just. Thank you so much.
Today's discourse is just a confirmation that the right processes weren't followed with this bill, and I think it has been met with universal opposition from civil society too. And I think the right thing should be that the committees should rejectable, and that it should go back, and that we should follow the right processes with regards to drawing up this bill.
Thank you, Chair. I was also just grappling with how this works in-house, and obviously it appears to me that there's capacity in-house, and the training is the training of that capacity to continue to do this. So it's people looking at it from within and not from without. So there's not a sort of an independent, removed kind of view. So if I'm right there, then I would also have that bit of concern that, well, the one thing I'd want to know is, and that my question probably wouldn't then be to you, it would be to the department, is this an ongoing, is the capacity used in an ongoing, so as the amendments are done, is it automatically, does the process kick in on the new amendments? But the concern would be that you kind of normally want a bit of an independent view of particularly the socioeconomic sort of impact, because you feel as if perhaps, if it's done from in-house, it's aimed at proving what there is okay. And so you could be a little myopic without meaning to be. Thank you.
Yeah, thanks, Honorable Chair. No, there's nothing much for myself. You see, the only concern is also about the timelines. I mean, are there any timelines, allocated for the department to, you see, because I'm trying to deal with the concerns that are raised by other stakeholders regarding the time before you take it to cabinet.
Yeah, no, thanks very much. We will then get the responses from the PMA, and after that we'll proceed to legal services. There will be time, members, when we have a session for final deliberations. That time is to look at everything that we have done holistically and then put our views across. So for now, we're just in a process. Over to you, DPME.
Thanks, Honorable Chair. Both myself and Pulani will attempt to answer all questions. If we don't, we can identify what we can do in written responses. But I think there's a consistency in the concern around the film and publications bill. Just to say, I mean, I think, Honorable Chair, Honorable Members, one of the things we didn't point out on the slides was that in actual fact, when we made the submission to Cabinet, there was an agreement that CS is applicable both to existing and old legislation. So that's important, because it's part of a process to understand that some other legislation that have been there, 22 years later, has a very different and a particular role and requires to be changed. But also those that continue to be a cost, and most likely have some social impact that may be negative requires that. But of course, the demand is that we doing the existing stuff that is coming, because that's actually what's happening right now. So a lot of it is what's new. And as you can see, Honorable Members, it's the 117 that we've done so far. There's a lot of demands on us to say, hey, we want to go back again. We want to do some of this stuff on old legislation. So in actual fact, I think that Honorable Members are confirming the process that, yes, our response to you is that any piece of legislation can be subject to CS, whether it's in the draft phase, whether it's completed, or whether it's starting. It's what template you apply. And to be honest, I think it's simply saying, can we go back? And you can ask the questions, and Honorable Members, I mean, we can circulate the template. The questions are very simple questions, right? They're very simple, but it requires for you to have a thought-through process. So you can't respond in a way that simply says, okay, and I do agree with you that sometimes, Honorable Member, you do have a response that provides you a justification of why you think this is important. It's why CS has to be signed off by the Department of Planning, Monitoring and Evaluation. So that's the external quality assurance. that you don't simply have someone developing a socioeconomic impact assessment and signs off to justify why that is there, and without taking into consideration the actual risks, the actual economic consequences, and probably saying what is out there in the public domain. Because we know what is sometimes said about some things in the public domain. We tend to just ignore it. So we can't ignore it. We have to say, well, this is a risk being raised, but this is how we think we can mitigate it or address it. And it's therefore up to Parliament to decide, is that mitigation or the ability to address it sufficient enough? But the risk is raised. That's the most important thing. You can't ignore the risk. So I think that's fundamental. And we are happy. I mean, the Department of Communication, we've worked with them on a number of other pieces that are going to come to you where we've done CSs. And I think it's important that, you know, it can be subject to CS. We apply the second template, we look at the issues in relation to that and say that. So the second point that I think it's important, the time spent, the amount of effort is determined by the level of complexity. So if you draw a graph, the more complex it becomes, it's determined by the work. So if a public, if we know, for instance, that what we're trying to achieve is fairly complex, it requires a great amount of effort, right? It requires to bring in most possibly some kind of experts. But here's the difference, and I think this is what we were trying to say earlier, Honorable Chairman, is that generally when we did RIA, we outsourced it. So let me use a good example, an example that's always been discussed. Let's use the Labor Act. It's not applicable to you, but I want to use the Labor Relations Act because I think lots of honorable members see the controversy that it has, right? So we use the Labor Relations Act. We then say, okay, if you're going to make amendments around basic conditions of employment, let's say, for example, leave pay, you know, we then outsource it to a Professor Arun Bharat, who's not in government, but is an expert on labor market. But what happens is that the official, right, who is responsible for the policy design, outsources it and says, go and write a piece on what the socioeconomic impact is of these things. Now, when the official does that, he's outsourcing his ability to think also about the risks. And this is what this process prevents. You can't outsource your ability to think and understand the risk, right? Because Professor Arun Bharat will say something. Whether you internalize it is a different case altogether. And so the system is designed for you to take ownership from the start. You must complete the template. You must do the rest stuff. You can contract in to a minimum someone, depending again on the complexity. You can contract someone in, depending on the complexity of the information that is required. And like Polanyi had said, NHI is a good example. It's, you know, the health economy is a complex thing. You have to do some measurement of cost benefits. You have to understand what it would be, whether the fiscus will be able to pay this, are we going to get private investment in this kind of stuff. So you'd have to bring that in. But the point about it is not to outsource it and give it to someone else and say, you think for me, and then you come present. Because what you had, honorable members, to be honest, if you had a RIA, the official would say, here's the expert who did the RIA, can you present? That's not what we want. We want the official who are responsible for that to present and say, we've internalized this, and we think that's the most important part about this. The second component that I just want to do, so we're prepared to work with the Department of Communication. We have an excellent relationship with the acting DG and his team on a number of other areas that we work with, and we'd spend a bit of time doing that through doing this. The second question that I thought that you had raised, which is the one around how you deal with conflict, and the Polanyi could deal with some of the other more difficult ones, is that the intention was never to design to deal with conflict, but as we went along, we realized that there was our first training session, honorable members. There was a particular department, and I won't mention the name of the department. They had sent legal services, and they sent policy people. They've never met each other, right, in the same department. So they would do policy and send it to legal to write it. But they never actually came together and said, so what would be the best design of something? So we brought them together for the first time, right, so in one department. So there's many examples of how we've been able to, in actual fact, say the risk is greater because we have no coherence within government before we go into the public domain. There are many examples. Let me use one example that Polanyi has been actively involved in, which has gone, for example, to cluster. Is the Marines, again, it's not related to you, but here's a specific area that's related to you, honorable members. So the Marine Spatial Planning Policy. So the Department of Environmental Affairs is in the process, as part of the Oceans Pakisa, having mandated to develop a marine spatial plan. Now, when they initially developed this thing, it was, in a sense, I thought that the Polanyi and I were very critical of it because we thought this is quite an interesting space. You know, we have land spatial plan, but we never did marine spatial planning. Now, there's quite a bit of implications for DOT shipping lanes, right? And if we declare, for example, you know, an area that is marine protected, you can't have shipping lanes. It affects you because SEACOM, right? So if you declare area that's marine protected, you can't have your cables running through there suddenly, right? So that has a problem. It affects the fishing industry because then you can't fish in that area. So when we initially designed this process, it was a, you know, quite a process that DF thought, okay, we'll get this thing easily done. But as we went into the process, we brought together other departments into the discussion. We said, these are the risks. How do you deal with marine shipping? How do you deal with cabling for, you know, for SEACOM? How do you deal with fishers? How do we deal with all different aspects? And I think we convinced them to understand that this requires a much more lengthy consultative process to be brought together. And we've been very successful in doing that. So initially they wanted to rush this thing and bring it to cabinet. In actual fact, we've added on a few more months for good purpose to be able to do that. There are many other examples that we can use, Honorable Chair, but that's one example, for instance, where we're able to bring together different departments to understand aquaculture bill, there's, you know, we can go on hydrographic bill, we can go on for all 117 and show in factual fact that the purpose that we've done was to bring together people, not only people across departments, but people within departments to have a discussion about how the conflicts can arise. I generally want to ensure that when it comes to you, honorable members and chair, is that you have a good sense of, okay, they thought through some of these things, right? And they've raised these issues, these risks, and whether they've dealt with it sufficiently or not, well, you know, at least they thought through it. You know, to debate for honorable members to say, we don't think you thought through it, but we can see you have raised it. Or for the public to say, well, actually, we don't think you thought through it adequately, but here's what we're suggesting. So this is the, and my last point, Honorable Chair, sorry, is that one of the other risks that we had with the regulated impact assessment was that it's, to be honest, let's be frank, a lot of it is not shared. So when you write up a RIA and you have 100 pages of why this thing should go or not, it's sometimes not shared. It's not in the public domain. Because sometimes when it says something against what a department wants, you don't want to share. Because then people will say, but even your own regulated impact assessment says you're not supposed to do it. The design of CS is for it to be in the public domain. And we've taken a resolution supported by Cabinet that in actual fact all socioeconomic impact assessments that we have signed off as DPME is put onto the website and is publicly accessible. So people see the thought through process. People can comment on the CS. They can even do their own CS. Thank you, Honorable Chair.
Ngati Savana, as you deal with the responses, because we won't come back to this discussion. I know you raised a number of issues that are in interest to members, and the examples, the space you are dealing with is where I come from agriculture, which includes fisheries. On page 12, Pauline, just expand on bullet 1, 2, 3, 4, the CS champions. Remember, we're a department. We're oversighting the Department of Communication. Do we have that person here? So that you can just explain to us. because we need the champions so that we know who are they and all of that.
Thanks, Chair. The CS champions are actually the point of coordination in a department. So they don't do CS for other units, but they coordinate. So also even for the planning, to say how many policies or bills that you are going to work on a particular financial year and what are the time frames. So it also assists us as DPME to better plan and provide support while it's still early within the department. So the CS champion for communication is Mr. Colin Mashile, who has been appointed by the... He was appointed by the acting DG to be the CS champion for the department. And there was a question on clarity on the induction of 581 in the previous financial year. So our approach is that when we provide support and facilitate on the application, we don't want to see a one-man person. We say call all other units that are also affected by your policy proposal or your bill so that they can, you know, participate in the CS and be able to make some contribution to your proposal. So hence we have so much coverage. We don't believe in just giving templates to department. We facilitate, we help them how to do the CS, but when we receive the report, we pretend that we are not part of the facilitation. The independent role kicks in where we make independent inputs. So we also have within DPME the outcome facilitators who are specialists on different areas. So they also provide that support over and above the capacity that we have. So Chair, I must indicate for the submissions that we have for first quarter, second, the turnaround time, the average turnaround time was 14 days to process the CS report. And then for the second quarter, it was 16 days. So that's the average turnaround time. We don't want to delay the process. And one of the things that helps with the whole, you know, that we are able to deal with the CS reports quicker is this process map to say, don't call us towards the end when you have to submit to the clusters and treat CS as you know, as a process that comes at the end. You start with CS in the whole policy and legislation development. So now we become familiar with your policy throughout, so it doesn't even have to take time because we've been part of the process. So it allows us to be able to process certain issues at an early age. So that's basically why we also have a quicker turnaround time. And also from the planning side, we always say to a department, plan ahead. When you know you have to introduce a bill to Parliament, work backwards, include also risks in between, include also your consultation with your stakeholders and all those issues. Include like also the political cycle. If maybe it's an election year, don't overcommit yourself that you're going to submit 10 bills to Parliament. You need to, you know, factor all those issues in your planning. So that's the other issue that we are dealing with in terms of also planning for the influx of legislations and the like, so that we are not delaying the system.
Honourable Chair, just on inductions, on training, the training that we conducted was for officials of departments who are going to be, so many of them initially in the first sets of who are going to do work are responsible for doing their particular regulations or bills, right? So we wanted them to come in to do that because part of the exercise was, so you can imagine initially when we started off, many of them said, ah, come on, you're adding on more complexity to our life and we've got a burden with this thing. But I think the process of understanding that this has to be integrated into your work has been very successful. You know, so people think about this all the time. So the inductions of all the training that we've done, it's not external people, it's all officials from either policy or legal that have come to the training, and we continue to sit with them through training them on using the template. Our capacity is, so we try and have a quick as possible turnaround time, and we're given commitment of 2 weeks, right, to do it. So some of it, again, complex legislation takes a bit of time, and we have to spend a bit of time going through it. But in actual fact, I mean, I think our capacity is, we're growing as DPME, Honourable Chair, so we're expanding our capacity to be able to deal with much more. It's been fairly steady, because I think one of the things, so I know Honourable Member says, how do we deal with managing the influx, Honourable Van Wyk? I mean, what does help with this thing is the actual fact, what we initially saw was people just quickly sending it through and thinking that it's going to be quick. But in actual fact, when they started doing the template, they actually went back without even asking. I said, okay, we'll call you when we're ready. Right? So it made them think about what problem they're trying to address and how they want to do it and what it is. So in actual fact, when they started seeing, they actually went back and withdrew. You actually saw a sense of not trying to rush through things simply for rushing it and getting it through in terms of compliance. But in actual fact, some of the agenda items for some of the clusters, and even for cabinet, they withdrew it and said, oh, no, we're not ready yet. We want to do some further work on that. And that's good. It delays, but I think that's what's happened. So we don't have a massive influx all the time. I think there's a steady flow, and we're able to manage it. We're able to get in teams where we're able to support that, and I think that's been independent. Honourable Chair, I think that's all the questions that we received. If there are more, we're willing to put.
Thank you very much. It's Honourable Van Schalvik, not Van Vijk. And the Satat is under. Thank you very much, the PME. I hope whenever we pick up the phone or write a letter, you will be available. You are part of this committee for good in this term. Or will you change? Because when people will understand us and understand the department, and until the end of the term. Thanks a lot. Members, I think we are covered because where we are going to is engaging the bill now from the side of the legal services. This was a beautiful presentation, tools for us to deal with the bill. We agree, Ms. Mimas. Thank you very much. Thanks, DPME. And if you have time, you may sit and listen. That would be very important for you. And then at the time, you can go to Gauteng. I know you from Pretoria. Yeah. That's where head office is. Until you carry out the decision of Parliament going elsewhere. Parliament is still in the Western Cape now. And please remember that not in the next 10 years, maybe, not in the foreseeable future. It's going to take a very long time, but the President has spoken. I now have the apology of the Deputy Minister. He's here. But I think members, I must also inform members and the department and the guests. You remember, most we had the Chief Whip called Stone Susan in Parliament. Her mother died, and funeral is tomorrow. In a place called Alexandria in the Eastern Cape, Emnyameni ngesiXhosa. It's 100 km from Port Elizabeth towards East London. Only 100 km. You take an hour's drive. And the Honourable Nesi is same distance. So the towns are not far from each other. And both funerals are tomorrow. It was just to inform you, because most of you know the former Chief Whip. I think I've spent 5 minutes speaking, allowing the bioscope to be ready.
Whilst we are getting ready, members, prepare yourselves, members of the committee, to be available next week. Just prepare yourselves to be available next week and block your days from Wednesday to Friday. When everything is in place, the inquiry will start. So just block those days. As you agreed yesterday, the other thing that will shelve as legal is getting ready. The other thing will shelve until later. You remember in the program there was SABC, annual reports and all that. That will shelve until after the PRRR. So you will have a revised program. That doesn't have SABC next week, because we'll be starting that process. Legal services, are you almost there? Over to you.
Greetings to all the honorable members and greetings to everyone in the house. Chairperson, with the introduction and the first presentation that has taken place, it basically minimizes some of my slides which I had prepared to speak to, especially in respect of what the previous presenters have dealt with. Hence, I will basically, as I understand, members do have copies of my presentations, as I have shifted the slides, and what I intend to address will now not include the RIA or the SESA, as has already been discussed on the second slide of my presentation, which was addressing what to address. And then I'll go straight to Section 18 of the Traditional Leaders Framework Act, and then I will address the constitutional issues that are related to the bill. Therefore, as I've said, the other slides that I've quickly gone past through are the slides that were speaking to the SESA, or what was previously called the RIA. So, Chairperson, I will go straight to slide number 8 of my presentation, which deals with the constitutional issues that the committee should consider and what has also transpired out of the stakeholder presentations or the public hearing.
The slides are not numbered. Can you look at the headings? The heading is constitutional issues, as reflected there.
Thank you, Chairperson. Basically, the first point was to indicate that this bill has been tagged as a Section 75, and it basically means that it does not fall on the subject matters or subject areas that are listed on the schedules of the Constitution, but it falls, if you look at Section 44, it's under the matter that gives the power for Parliament to legislate on any other matter, and this is one instance which speaks to that. While one was looking at the issue of tagging, the question perhaps, as they were raising, that they want to protect children as well as consumers that are using the internet in this instance, whatever protection that the bill sought to provide, One was questioning whether it would not then fall on the question of consumer protection as a functional subject area that is listed there. But through all the legal processing and thinking through in the tagging process, we were satisfied, and also the JTM confirmed by approving that it should be a Section 75 bill, and so it's a matter that does not really fall into that ambit of consumer protection. Moving on to the second point, there was also a question which was raised in relation to the presentation that the content advisor had presented, and it related to whether or not to involve the National House of Traditional Leaders. Basically, that was noted because at the end of the bill, there is a memorandum of understanding which also seeks to explain the process. I have taken liberty to make copies of the specific section in the Traditional Leadership Framework and Governance Act so that members would understand where that comes from as a legal requirement, that when a bill is basically in its content pertaining to customs or customary law or traditional communities, then it's a legal requirement that it must be sent to the National House of Traditional Leaders, and that legal requirement is derived nowhere else other than Section 18 of the specific Act, the Traditional Leaders and Governance Framework Act. However, as already pointed out in the Memorandum of Understanding, in the Memorandum of Objects of this bill, the state law advisor, as well as ourselves, when we were giving the opinion to the JTM, it was indicated that fortunately, after looking at the content and considering everything that this bill seeks to achieve, there is nothing that pertains to customary law or customs or traditional communities as indicated and as per the interpretation of Section 18. Hence, that explanation which came was based on that section, as well as to give a proper context as to where the legal requirement comes from, as well as indicating that even though there is a legal requirement from Section 18, it does not then necessarily mean that if the National House of Traditional Leaders wants to influence the bill, it is excluded from the processes, but it becomes as part of the stakeholders or whoever is interested in making an input when there is a bill before Parliament. And that was basically in respect of the issues then that were raised pertaining to whether the National House of Traditional Leaders should not be given an opportunity to deal or comment on this bill as per the legal requirement. Sorry, Chairperson. Then now I will move straight to the very contentious and burning issues of the bill, and those are the provisions now in respect of the bill itself. And we start with clause 2 read together with clause 16. I will just quickly check what I see now. The next slide is moving straight to clause 17 when it should deal with clause 16. In respect of clause 16, if we look at the bill, I think so that we go in a structural manner, let us start with clause 2 of the bill. And clause 2 of the bill, I am trusting that members do have copies of the bill itself, because
in terms of organizing the documents, members do have this, and then the additional discussion matters, this small document. I think it's a two-pager.
Yes.
Yes. this document, and you were saying the bill itself?
I'm saying, thank you, Chairperson. In fact, those two documents are to be used together, because that other document that the Chairperson has just raised up, it's an addendum, some form of a detailed account as to the clause that I thought they need to be brought to the attention of the committee. So there is that copy, which I will now also run with it in conjunction with the presentation that is before you. But if you look at that addendum, the first clause that we're looking at is clause 2 of the bill, read together with clause 5, because I was quickly just trying to run through the issues that the stakeholders raised, as well as in line with what the constitutional judgments in respect of this principal act and the proposed amendments have said. So if we look at clause 2 of the bill, it's basically the provision that seeks to address issues in relation to adding the penalty committee. Because if you look at the principal act, section chapter 2 of the principal act, it deals with the structures that are necessary to implement this act. And in that respect, there is the Feelings and Publication Board, the Appeal Tribunal, the Council, as well as now the amendment proposes to add the penalty committee. For me, the legal questions that are also were arising out of what the stakeholders had indicated, it was to seek whether the department can explain in respect of the principal act as well as the bill, to bring about the relationship that we'll have on the penalty committee and its functions, as well as how then will the penalty committee work together with the board and the council as they appear as the existing structures in terms of the principal act. In other words, the crucial question is how do all these structures differ and what it is that necessitate the existence of this new penalty committee, and what are the different capacities that this penalty committee will bring to the different functions that the existing structures are already doing. Then the second point was, as already raised by the stakeholders, is the independence issue of this very committee, because if you look at all those structures and how the appointment is done, it was also a question of concern that it is a ministerial appointment, and the resulting question there is the issue of independence when you are doing the function and dependent as to the process that you are appointed, as well as to who your appointed authority is, and then the issue of dealing with control, as well as the extent of exercising your functions and your powers, understanding that. I think that's an issue that also, if you look at the amendments, it doesn't still come out clear. As I indicated, that we know that the state law advisors, together with the department, have made some proposals which will also be discussed through an A list. From the ones that I have seen, this issue was also not covered in those proposed amendments. So possibly, maybe when they take the podium, they will be explaining that issue of independence, as well as the necessity of having this penalty committee. And then the last point on clause 2, read together with the other clauses, under clause 6 is just an issue of drafting, because if you look at that clause 6, there is a reference that into the number 10. There is a number 10 written as a figure, and there is a number 10 written as a word, just for purposes of drafting and also to bring it to the attention of the committee, because normally when we do amendments to questions that you never brought to the attention of the committee, it then becomes an alert as to where did you get the instruction to deal with that correction. But that one is merely on drafting concerns. It's not a substantial concern. Now we move to clause 16. If you look at the addendum again, clause 16 of the bill is basically seeking to amend section 16 of the Principal Act. And I think I should mention this at this stage, that in respect of the Constitutional Court judgments, the print media judgment was basically trying to deal with the very issues that we are grappling with as we are deliberating on this bill today. And that is why most of the presentations, when we're done during the public hearings, most of the submitters were saying this bill is unconstitutional because it was stemming from their interpretation as well as their understanding of what the Constitutional Court has said in the print media judgment in respect of Section 24 of the Principal Act, as well as Section 16 and Section 24 of the Principal Act. And basically those sections in the Principal Act, they were bringing about the process to classify any publication before it becomes a publication. Now, the court was very clear, as the presenters did say, that if you look at Section 16 of the Constitution, which is the right to freedom of expression, that right has no built-in legal requirement that it should be further regulated. In other words, it's not like your other rights that appear on the Constitution to say it is an absolute clear right without any further regulation that must come to give effect or to give detail to it. In fact, the court has confirmed in the print media judgment that if you read Section 16 of the Constitution, it is a right that does not require a legal or a constitutional requirement to further regulate it so that it is properly implementable. But then the court further went on that if you look at what Section 16 of the Films and Publications Act, Section 16(2) of the Films and Publications Act had done then, it was exactly that. It brought in a further regulation to regulate a right, and the court found that to be unconstitutional and said any prior restraint or any prior administrative classification that is derived from a legislative instrument will become unconstitutional in a sense that the right itself does not enable or empower anyone to say further regulate on this right. Now, at paragraph 51 of the judgment, the court said freedom of expression is not one of those rights that require regulation in order to have effect or to give it effect. It stands as is. It does not require further regulation like any other rights. In other words, Section 16(2)(a) of the Principal Act was declared unconstitutional and invalid. And the other point I was going to bring at the end is that due to the judgments that have taken place, including the Derrick judgment, which in this regard was explaining the ambit and the extent of child pornography for purposes of this act, the court found it also to be unconstitutional. But what also one has seen, as you would, if you look at the Principal Act, I think it has been amended about 4 times. And those amendments have resulted out of the constitutional judgments, especially those two, the print media judgment as well as the direct judgment, which the department and the board kept on referring to in our previous engagements. Now, the principal acts as it stands, and in line with what we have heard in respect of the impact assessment that needs to be done for either an existing statute or for a proposed legislation, there is a serious problem in respect of this bill as well as the Principal Act itself. If you look at the Principal Act, it has provisions that have been repealed by the previous acts that have already been enacted. And now it becomes a very humongous task to understand and pierce it together so that you would understand how the implementer at the end stage of the whole process is implementing this legislation. And that becomes another crucial problem for this specific amendment. Because for now, as we know, that Section 16.2 was invalidated by the court. Hence, the department complied with the order of the court and they've removed it. So it's no longer part of the statute. Because if you look at the Act, the Principal Act, Section 16.2A of the Principal Act, of the Films and Publications Act, has come out. And in that previous instance, in fact, the bill proposes that Section 16.2A Section 16.2A of the Principal Act is proposed that it be deleted so that it aligns with what the constitutional judgment had indicated. And then the next proposal is that Section 16.2B, because as I've already indicated, Section 16 in the Constitution, the court has confirmed it requires no further regulation. It must stand as it is and it must be implemented as it is. In other words, it's a right that stands as is. And if there should be any limitation, it must be a constitutional limitation. And the court has already found, in respect of 16.2A, that such a limitation was not justified. So it couldn't be. Hence, it declared that provision that it must be out of the statute, and that is what the amendment seeks to achieve. In respect of 16.2, what the departments basically seek in terms of amending, it wants to change advocates into amounts. Now, this takes us back to Section 16.2 again of the Constitution, because it now addresses what Section 16.2 of the Constitution provides, which is already a prohibition if you read 16.2, because it says the right in subsection 1 does not extend to propaganda for war, incitement of imminent violence, or advocacy of hatred that is based on race, ethnicity, all the other grounds that are listed. So what the bill basically does with this amendment is not clear, except that it changes the word from advocacy to amounts. And as I point out in understanding the definition of the difference between amounts and advocacy, what advocacy does was bringing some ambiguity. And amounts basically says, if your publication does amounts to propaganda for war, you will be in trouble. But that's already what the Constitution does. So it doesn't really make much sense whether we change amounts or we change advocacy, because in Section 16.2, those are already things that are not protected even by the right to expression. So once you engage in all those things that are mentioned in 16.2b, you will be in trouble because of what the Constitution provides.
Just hold on. If we are not disturbing you, we don't have the principal act, Moses. What we have, Tina, is the amendment piece. It is one. I think it's fine to refer to the principal act in line with your notes. And there are no slides for all that, isn't it? Because this is a Latin.
It is covered in the addendum, Chairperson, but I think, yes.
Okay.
On the bullet points, as I address clause 16,
yeah.
It is covered. And
okay.
I think you'll put your finger where the challenge is. I think we're getting empowered. But because we're getting empowered on legalities, it becomes important that whatever is explained is written as articulated verbally, so that there's no difference at all between what is verbally expressed in essence and what is on. Because when she leaves, we must be able to go. If that detail is there, then she can refer that. I'm fine, but I'm enjoying the length. But I feel I've got this disability that you seem to be expressing myself.
Tina, we rely more on this and the amendment please. And the constitution. Mm. As you quote the constitution.
It's here.
We have the constitution.
Mm.
What our disability is the principal act. Where our disability is the principal act. But if you have something that can clarify on your slides what we are talking about, I think it will be helpful for us.
Okay, Chairperson. Basically, because now I've been disorientated by the presentation that took place first, the slides that relate to Section 16 and Clause 16 are basically no presentation, but they relate to what I've said in respect of the judgment. And if you look at, I don't know, maybe when the printing, it decided not to have the numbers because I did put insert the slide numbers. On the presentation slides, from where it says print media and the judgment continued, all those pages, on my slide it says page 12, but it's titled Print Media Judgment Continued Until Prior Restraints Justification. Those are the provisions that basically relate to Section 16 and Clause 16, which I'm talking to right now. But the slides, as I said, they were going to come at the end when I round off to say then what is before you and what the court have said. How does it connect all up together? But unfortunately, in my preparing the slide, I put that all together as per what the court said in line with the judgment, because as I said, we already have two court cases that have spoken to this issue and they are very straightforward. And I was just trying to then bring you on the initial documents as they stand, and then at the end, as I said, those slides are providing all that I'm saying they are there. It's just that they are at the end of the presentation. Now, if perhaps I will come back to the other clauses that are in between 16 and 23, which are of crucial importance. But 16, clause 16 and section 16 of the Principal Act, as it already stands, It is to be read together with clause 24, which, for purposes of the bill, the department wanted to deal with just changing the penalties that are to address the criminality of what you do in terms of Section 16. And so even the judgment had already addressed that issue. And if we jump on the addendum, we jump straight to clause 24. In clause 24 of the bill, it determines the maximum cap of penalties of offenses committed, especially in respect of Section 16 and Section 18. In other words, what the court had said and what I've already pointed out, that this is a very confusing process as well as the Act itself as it stands currently, because there are provisions that have come out in light of what the judgments have said. They have already repealed them, and now there is this proposal which does not seem to be in sync with what the actual Act is as it currently stands. It's like we are doing piecemeal amendments whenever we've come across a glitch or a mischief, rather than as has explained, that if you follow the SESA process, you are able to connect the dots where they are missing. So, for instance, if we go back to clause 18, which seeks to amend section 18. Section 18, together with section 17, was supposed to have had some schedules that were attached to the bill. But throughout the repeal processes that have previously taken place, those which were to be guidelines for the public at large, as well as the classifiers who are doing the already declared unconstitutional prior classification, the criteria and the guideline is already missing due to the schedules that were explaining being taken off or repealed. Now we are only left with Section 18 of the Principal Act, which Section 18 basically now tells you that if it is to be a child pornography classified publication, this is what you would have done wrong. Hence, it says in order for a classification to be brought to the FPB, you look at Section 18, and it is to guide them that to classify the publication, this is what it must meet. But now it creates that problem, because it brings back the question to say, before you can express yourself or give effect to the right to freedom of expression, take your work or your publication to the board and have them classify it. And as already we know, prior classification limits your rights. And that limitation, in terms of the way that the Principal Act wants it, the court has already said, it is not a constitutional way. Therefore, even these amendments as they come, Section 61 still, because it hasn't been removed or out of the statute, or it is not being amended here now, Section 16(1) of the Principal Act, it actually requires a person to request a classification for publication. It reads as follows for purposes of the members, because they do not have the copy. It says, any person may request in the prescribed manner that a publication other than a bona fide newspaper that is published by a member of the body recognized by the Press Ombudsman, which subscribes and adheres to the code of conduct, must be enforced by that body, which is to be or is being distributed in the Republic, be classified in terms of this section. In other words, 16(1) of the Principal Act is the enabling provision that gives the power to the FPB to classify the publications. But now, that provision, even though the judgments were not specifically looking to 16.1, but as an enabling provision, it creates the problem that prior classification has been legislated, but the court has already indicated that there is a problem with such a prior classification if it is to be legislated. Now, together, if you look at 16.1 of the Principal Act and Section 18, as I've said, they give us the classification process. And that classification process is the process that if you look at the judgments in its entirety, you would basically worry and say, it is the process that the court has indicated it is unconstitutional and therefore we need a better way other than what is provided for in the existing Principal Act. But what the amendment does for purposes of the committee and the work that it is doing now, in clause 18, and you must read it with section 16.1 of the Principal Act, as I have said, it just removes reference to child pornography and additional wording that publication relating to children must comply with guidelines for the protection of children. So it basically, in a very limited way, seeks to give effect to the Dirup judgment, which is the constitutional judgment, is the constitutional court judgment that has dealt with all the issues that related to child pornography. And it gave details into that regard. But then, as was raised by the stakeholders did indicate that there is an act, which is the Criminal Sexual Offences Act, which has a specific full chapter, which is Chapter 3. And when I was doing my preparations, I also requested the committee secretary to make that addendum available to the members. The Criminal Law Sexual Offences Act, in Chapter 3, it's a whole chapter that seeks to address all the issues of sexual assault or sexual abuse that is experienced by children, including child pornography. And if we recall, the other stakeholders had mentioned that it creates a sink problem or a problem to make it impossible to have legislation that is consistent and that can actually be able to overlap with one another without creating conflict if you seek to address a problem that will only be specific to your portfolio. That is why the other submitters had indicated, in fact, that why not leave things that are addressed in the criminal justice system to be addressed properly within the criminal justice system rather than deal with them haphazardly and separately as this has been the case. The issues in terms of the sexual child pornography issues were addressed in that judgment, and again, through Chapter 3 of the Sexual Offences Act, it is sufficient to address what is basically being raised in this instance. Now, in bringing together all these issues that I have raised, is to say the following. The court, the Constitutional Court, has given us a clear interpretation of all these instruments. And it has given us the guideline to say that even though the intentions of this act may have been stipulated as basically as I note them there, it says the main purposes of the Principal Act, that is the Films and Publications Act as it stands before we amended it, it was A, to provide a consumer protection to those who use internet and online publications. B, areas to protect children from harmful exposure or age-inappropriate material, and lastly, to ban and prohibit child pornography. Now, as I have indicated, had the proper assessment done, even if it was that old term which was only looking at the regulatory impact assessment, all the regulation that is in our statute books in relation to all the intentions that this Act sought to achieve, they would have known that a lot has been done, and a lot has been done to correct whatever mischief that has been picked up in relation to what this bill sought to do. But at the same time, there would also it would have been a process that appreciates that all the repeal that has happened to the Principal Act, it creates problems and it still opens other vacuums that are left open without anything to assist legislatively. Now, the other problem that the court has also picked up, and I am also mentioning here, is that the Principal Act was finalized, or it went through its process, it went through its legislative process either around or before 1995. And that was before the constitution process was finalized and the certification process was confirmed in court. Hence, the constitution is the 1996 Act. Now, as already the department in our previous engagements, they admitted that the SAFA or regulatory impact assessment has not happened in respect of either the Principal Act or now possibly all the other amendments that have come for purposes of this Act. Whatever has amended this Act, there is an open issue to say chances are the impact assessment was not done on them. And hence the problems and the challenges that we are facing as this now becomes a technical bill, as well as if you look ahead, it is likely to create further operational difficulties when the Act must be implemented. The problem then arises is that the legislative process would be a wasted process, if I may, for lack of proper words, a wasted process, if I may say so. Because as I've said, we seem to be doing only piecemeal amendments when a specific problem has been identified. And from the comments of the stakeholders, it was clear that there's a lot of other issues that would arise and that are ignoring what already exists. And in that light then, Chairperson, and if we look at the legislative process that we have, it was pointed out in our previous engagement that, in fact, National Assembly Rules 2864, as it outlines what is required of the committee, and what I was trying to explain last time when I was explaining the impact of RIA and its implications, as well as when the issue of the motion of desirability was raised. To bring those together and provide a way forward in trying to support or direct the committee. Having seen and heard what the stakeholders have heard, and what the Department of DPME has indicated, there is definitely going to be a problem to have a positive motion of desirability for this bill. But that also can be addressed when the committee has looked into everything that the that is going to be presented before the committee, because as I've indicated, the department has prepared an A-list which seeks to attempt to address all the concerns that have been raised previously. So we do not know whether the A-list would answer and correct all the defects, or it will still leave the problem as identified by the stakeholders and as I've also pointed out on the constitutional and legal issues. But the motion of desirability, which will be part of the report of the committee once all the deliberations have been finalized, it would indicate then that in terms of everything that the committee has done, this is the view that the committee takes and proposes to the House to say, because of A, B, C, D and all those things which still remain unresolved, the motion of desirability for this bill is basically to suggest that the House take it no further until there is correction on the problems that have been raised. But the problems that the stakeholders and I myself am raising here, we will only know whether they are addressed in the A list that they are proposing. But the bill as it stands, it's still very problematic. Thank you, Chairperson.
Thank you very much. So you hear, members. And it will be necessary just to break for a few minutes, in fact, five. Do we have tea? We don't. Just a stretch break so that we can go wherever we want to go and then come back. We may come back at 10 to 12.